Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. My name is Andrew Sola, and I'm at the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg. So you in the audience might not know that Chicago and Hamburg are sister cities, and to celebrate the sister city relationship, we are going to explore Chicagoland in around 1776 and a little bit before. And this special episode is sponsored by the Senatskanzlei of the city of Hamburg, so I just want to thank them for their support. My expert guest on the history of Chicago in the Great Lakes region is Professor Ted Karamanski. Welcome, Ted.
Hello, Andrew.
Ted Karamanski is Professor of History and Director of the Public History Program at Loyola University in Chicago. He is a lifelong resident of the Chicago area and the author of 10 books on Great Lakes regional history. His Native American publications include the book Blackbird's Song, Andrew J. Blackbird and the Odawa People, which was published by Michigan State University Press in 2012. So you all know that the Declaration of Independence was released to the public on the 4th of July, 1776. You might also know that the city of Chicago was not founded until 1837. So what's the historical connection, you might be wondering? Good question. Also, you might know that the Declaration was signed in Philadelphia, which is about 760 miles or 1,200 kilometers east of Chicago. That's a long distance. It's roughly the distance between Hamburg and Munich. So did the native people of Chicagoland even know what was going on in the 13 colonies around 1776? Well, there were indigenous people in the Chicago area for millennia, and they had complex civilizations, cities, and trade networks. Indeed, as we learned in the second episode already in this series, obsidian points have been found around the Great Lakes, which proves that indigenous trade networks ranged thousands of miles into modern-day Mexico. Not only did native peoples have vast trade networks, but they built urban centers that rivaled the size of colonial cities and even European cities. So don't forget that in 1700, the combined population of the great colonial cities, Boston, New York, and Philadelphia, was only 13,000 people. At the same time, the Mandan tribe on the banks of the Missouri River had cities consisting of 10 to 20,000 people. And even going back to the 14th century, the city of Cahokia on the Mississippi River had a population of maybe 20,000, even more, making it larger than the city of London at the time. So these are some of the misconceptions we discussed in episode 2 about Native peoples. And today we're going to learn more about the Native peoples of Chicagoland. How much had they already interacted with European powers? How aware were they of the 13 colonies and their political strife with King George? And lastly, did they even care about the Declaration of Independence? So, Ted, why don't you just get us started by introducing us to the Native tribes in the Chicago area around 1776.
So you indicated that the native people of Eastern Central North America had had long association with the European colonial powers. And certainly in the Great Colonial War, known in Europe as the Seven Years' War, known in the Americas as the French and Indian War, native people were deeply involved in that conflict, and the repercussions of that reverberated as far into the interior as the site of what's now the city of Chicago. And as was the case for so many Indian people of the interior, they had sympathized with the French cause. The French Empire had claimed vast territories, you know, stretching in a grand arc from Quebec all the way down to New Orleans. That was just a claim. They just had a few posts in the interior, and this was essentially native ground. And so this was one of the reasons that native people favored the French, because after all, the French were supplying them with up-to-date trade goods from Europe. but were not at all impeding on their territorial sovereignty. They heard rumors of what the British were up to along the coast of the Atlantic, and it was a different situation, and they understood that. So when the Whigged ministers of Europe got together in Paris in 1763 and brought an end to the Seven Years' War, they made the decision that all of Eastern North America, from the Atlantic to the Mississippi, was going to be British territory. This was something that was beyond the scope of what native people would have thought was just, or something that they were willing to recognize. And so this triggers, when the British begin to come into the interior of the continent as conquering masters, a rebellion on the part of native people. And this was the famous Pontiac's Rebellion that breaks out and lasts for about a year and a half, leads to the attack and massacre of a number of British garrisons in the interior. But eventually, the native people reconcile with the British, largely because they don't want to fight a long-term war, and also because the supplies that they had become dependent upon, and here we're talking mainly about clothing items and access to firearms and the repair of firearms, after a couple of years of being denied this in their rebellion against the British, they needed access to that again, and that was coming through the St. Lawrence Valley into the eastern Great Lakes, all controlled by the British. So sooner or later, they felt they had to make a deal with the British. This gets us to Chicago eventually, because native people who did not want to reconcile with the British began to regroup in the area south and west of Lake Michigan, near where the cities of Chicago and Milwaukee eventually arise. They moved there because it was more remote from British influence, but they could still get those vital trade goods they needed, because another one of the deals made in Paris in the 1760s was that the area west of the Mississippi River, which had been France's Louisiana colony, was transferred to the Spanish. And the French traders who had worked in the Mississippi Valley very much reconciled to Spanish overlordship. It was another Catholic power. So they were able to still operate out of the new city that had just been founded in 1760, St. Louis. And so traders from St. Louis were able to move up the Mississippi and then the Illinois River and keep supplied tribes that were antagonistic to the British in the Chicago area. They were able to still be supplied, so they didn't need to make friends with the British.
At least in the 1770s.
Right. Yeah. And the British were anxious about this. There was a constant correspondence back and forth. It's like, you know, what's with these people? How come we can't deal with them? When English traders would try to come into the Chicago area or into northern Indiana, they would be attacked, robbed, and often murdered by the tribes who felt they were sending a message, Englishmen, we don't want you.
Were those tribes pushed west?
Yeah, it wasn't so much they were pushed west. The area south and west of Lake Michigan, for a considerable amount of time in the 18th century, had been the home of a group of people known as the Sauk or Fox Indians. And they had a long series of wars with some of the other Algonquin tribes who were allied with the French. And so from about 1713 to 1740, the area south and west of Lake Michigan was kind of a battleground. And so it wasn't safe for people really to live there. They'd pass through there, but nobody was really living there. The upshot of that was that the area had not been heavily trapped. The resources in that area had a chance to sort of recover. And by the time we get to the 1750s, 1760s, you have Odawa and Potawatomi people moving into that area because it's sort of an unclaimed niche.
Interesting. So I think it's important to stress the point here, and you've been implying this, but the native peoples around Chicagoland had plenty of interactions prior to 1776 with French traders and with English traders, maybe going back 200 years, roughly?
Roughly. So it began in 1673. When the French first come into the Illinois country, first pass through the area of the Chicago Portage.
So about 100 years they had been experienced European traders.
Right.
Good. Okay. You'd mentioned some of the tribes. Can we just maybe go through a little bit of what we know about each of those tribes in the Chicagoland area around that period?
Right. So these were people who would have called themselves Anishinaabe. And the Anishinaabe people were what they called the Three Fires Confederacy. That is, three closely aligned tribal groups who, in the distant, distant past, had taken a long migration from somewhere along the Atlantic coast down the St. Lawrence and into, they were sort of on a mission from God, if you will, because they had a spiritual force guiding them. And the spiritual force that they would settle in a land where the food grows out of the water. And this was a place where wild rice would sprout, as well as a very abundant fishery. And so these three groups later become known historically as the Ojibwa, or Chippewa, sometimes they're known, the Odawa or Ottawa, and the Potawatomi. And when they get to the area where Lake Huron and Lake Michigan come together, where the city of Mackinac Island is today, there they split up. And the Potawatomi went south. The Odawa stayed at the forks of the two lakes, and the Ojibwa go west into Lake Superior country. But they speak a commonly understood language and have very similar cultural traits. And so over the course of the centuries, they often would intermarry with one another. And what we see happen in the 1740s, 1750s, is groups of Odawa and groups of Potawatomi coming into this newly vacated area around Chicago, Milwaukee, coming in there and settling in villages that are part Potawatomi, part Odawa, and villages that are formed really around marriage alliances.
Good. So we have those three primary tribes. And maybe we can just think a little bit about now their lifestyle, the lifestyle of the Indians who lived there.
The reason that they had come to that territory was because it allowed them to really fully engage in their economic practice, which was what they would call a seasonal round. And based on the season of the year, they would exploit different niches in the ecosystem. So maybe in summer, they might live closer to inland lakes or even to Lake Michigan itself. And engage in offshore fishing. They would also plant crops of corn in the summers. In the fall, they would hunt waterfowl in marshier areas where the migrating birds would be found. These same areas, they could harvest wild rice there, growing in the marshy grounds. And then in winter, they would break up into smaller units and go to winter hunting camps, where they would trap furs that could then be exchanged for trade goods that they needed, and which, as I indicated before, cloth was the most important, and access to ammunition and fixing firearms and things like that.
That was their practice for the 100 years prior to 1776, because the first French traders came 100 years. Do we have any sense of before that period, if they would be doing lots of trading with tribes around Yes. North America as well? And I'm just curious, would they actually go to some of these, for example, the Mandan cities that I spoke of in the little introduction? Would they be sending a group of Indian traders to these urban centers where trading was happening? Is that something that we would have expected of them too?
It's conceivable. Say the Odawa have some associations with some of the plains tribes, like the Pawnee, who had a similar lifestyle as the Mandans. But more likely, it comes filtered through shorter trade journeys. Tribes closer to the Missouri River, where the Mandan were, would have made trade, and then they would have taken some of that trade to tribes in the Mississippi Valley, who in turn would do exchanges with Great Lakes tribes.
Okay, good. So let's maybe get a little bit closer now to the American Revolution. The Seven Years' War has ended. Pontiac's War, you would think that this group, the three groups, the Ojibwe, the Potawatomi, and the Odawa, did or did not participate in Pontiac's War.
Okay, so politically, this is what some historians have called a village world. Every village, and these villages were not necessarily large, particularly in the Upper Great Lakes, so we're talking a village of 100, 200 people maybe. Each one of these villages made their own foreign policy. So what you have is the situation at the time that we're talking about, say the 1770s, is that some tribes went ahead and were totally against the British. Some villages were totally against the British. Some were very much closely aligned to them. So the Odawa, who lived up near where Lake Michigan and Lake Huron come together, very closely aligned to the British. They've got cousins, brothers, and sisters down in Chicago who are totally against the British. So it varies back and forth. But basically, the further east you were, then the more likely you were to be reconciled to the British and closely allied with them economically. And further away, then it was a good place for people who didn't like the British.
Okay, so what any of the three, I know you said that each village made its own foreign policy. Can we conceive of any of these tribes aligning with Pontiac directly?
Oh, definitely. So, for example—
And sending warriors?
And sending warriors. So one of the key events, perhaps the greatest coup of the Pontiac's Rebellion, is the capture of the British fort at Michilimackinac, where Lake Michigan and Lake Huron come together. The closest tribe to that were the Odawa at L'Arbre Croche village. They don't want to attack the British. We're making friends with them, no problem. The Odawa, who live on the other side of the Straits of Mackinac, they decide they're going to attack the British garrison. And by stealth, they capture the fort and massacre or capture all the British troops there and traitors. So it's just individual decisions that groups make.
To what extent, now I'm thinking of these British garrisons being burnt to the ground, British soldiers being killed. And now my perspective just here is focusing back to the colonies and to King George in London. To what extent can we say at this point the colonies sort of policy on Western expansion and interactions with the Native Americans is aligned with King George and Parliament's policy on the West and Western expansion?
Well, not at all.
Okay.
Because, you know, after Pontiac's Rebellion, I mean, the British in London say, hey, we don't want a war with the Indians. It's bad for business, and we're having to send more troops, which is a huge military expense. So, no. How do we avoid war with the Indians? let's keep people who aren't traders, people who are land speculators or farmers, keep them out of Indian territory so they don't antagonize. So the Proclamation of 1763 is issued, which essentially draws a line. You can't go west. Well, George Washington has already surveyed lands out there. He's involved in Benjamin Franklin, too. They're involved in companies that are selling shares to future prospects there. So, yeah, this is definitely what Americans regard as one of the intolerable acts, where the British are really going to attempt to impinge on the economic freedoms of English colonists.
I'm just maybe now trying to go back to my Declaration of Independence. Now, I have that the passage, of course, the final grievance we have. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Since the colonial perspective and the imperial perspective from London are drifting wildly apart, the colonists want to expand. London does not want this expansion. How do you read that passage from the Declaration of Independence in the context of what we've just been discussing?
It's basically they are well aware that the British have limited military presence in North America.
The colonists.
The colonists are aware, yeah, the British army is just not that big. And that the strategy that the French had used before is the strategy the English will use, and that is, if we fight a war in North America, we are going to have significant numbers of native allies on our side to be a force multiplier, whether we're fighting the French or we're trying to put down a domestic insurrection. And so that statement by Thomas Jefferson is an attempt to go ahead and say to Americans, do you remember the French and Indian Wars when the French got Indians attacking us and they're hitting homesteads on the frontier and they're getting burned and people are being scalped? That's what the British are going to do to us. That's the kind of people they are. So at that point, there hadn't really been any particular, you know, major Indian involvement attacking colonists, but that's what they were worried about. And in fact, you know, in 1775, the Americans launch an invasion of Canada in anticipation that they know if they can capture Montreal and Quebec and hold it, they can keep the British from influencing all those native tribes in the Upper Great Lakes region.
Fascinating. Is there anything else since I read that passage that you, any other comments you want to make about that line in the Declaration of Independence?
So it's sort of ironic in some ways that what we have in Chicago during the American Revolution are native people who eventually ally themselves with the American revolutionaries because they don't see them as a problem. They're way over there, you know, in Philadelphia and in Boston. But what they are worried about is the British who've got troops right there at the head of Lake Michigan. So the Indians see the British, the Indians in the Chicago area, see the British as the threat to their sovereignty. And they make an alliance and work with the American revolutionaries in a way that in the long term would probably be, you know, detrimental to their future. But it's not anticipated.
Right. That's really interesting because, again, you've made this point that even individual like Potawatomi villages would have their own relationships or sense of foreign policy with the British on the one hand, the French on the other, and then the American colonialists on a third hand. We see Indian tribes closer to the 13 original colonies, obviously having a totally different perspective on both the British and the colonials as well. And the colonists, of course, also, while the Indians were scalping colonists, the colonists weren't necessarily being totally honest in their dealings with the Native Americans either, were they?
Not at all.
Okay, so to what extent would you say that indigenous Chicago played a role in the American Revolution? Is this an afterthought, or, well, how would you describe that?
It's an afterthought in terms of the kind of negotiations that eventually end the revolution and secure American independence. But to the native people in the Chicago area, it was very significant. The native people there, and the British were aware that they were antagonistic to them. And so they actually, in 1778, they send a ship into Lake Michigan along the shore where Chicago is, and then up to Milwaukee, with the anticipation of capturing a couple of the chiefs they know by name to be antagonistic to the British. But they're unsuccessful in this. Meanwhile, the colony of Virginia, the state of Virginia, I guess, at that point in 1778, sends an expedition down the Ohio River of a few hundred men to capture British garrisons in southern Illinois and southern Indiana. And those troops, led by a man by the name of George Rogers Clark, he understands also that there's these antagonistic chiefs up by Lake Michigan by the Chicago Portage. And so he lays out a very substantial amount of money. He pays a French trader $200, which is the equivalent of $10,000 in today's money, to see if he can get some of these chiefs to come down and hold a council with him so they can plan joint military operations. This is successful. The British get wind of this, so they try to launch their own counterattack through Illinois, through Chicago, and across the Kankakee Portage, but they're not strong enough to really pull it off. And they get down the Mississippi, they get a small force to attack St. Louis, but the Spanish repulse it. Then those Chicago chiefs work with the Americans and the Spanish to launch their own attack. And so they march through Illinois, and there is a very influential English trading post at St. Joseph, where the St. Joseph River enters Lake Michigan in what's now southwestern Michigan, state of Michigan. And they attack this post and they capture it and really push back British influence all the way to the head of Lake Michigan. So these activities really go ahead and put the anti-British chiefs in the driver's seat. They really now are the ones who have the most influence in the region. They're being well supplied by the Spanish, who have also declared war on Great Britain as part of the American Revolution. So there are these events that take place far on the fringe of the frontier. The tricky thing is, what's the long-term significance of this, you know? And there we run into a problem. Historians have sometimes said, well, the fact that George Rogers Clark captured these British bases in southern Indiana, southern Illinois, and that the Indians and the Spanish attacked a British garrison up on Lake Michigan, that this had to play a role in the Treaty of Paris that ends the American Revolution in 1783. Maybe it's the reason that the American colonists get the border of their country from the Atlantic all the way to the Mississippi River.
Yeah, and how far north as well?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what Michigan was not a colony, of course.
No.
Is there an argument to be made that this sort of counterattack that pushed the British forces back ensured that Michigan, what is now the state of Michigan, would be part of a new United States?
So it's a warranted supposition. But if you look at the dialogue and discussions that Franklin and other negotiators, as well as Rockingham and British negotiators, if you look at what they wrote and what they said at the time, it never comes up.
Okay.
So there are events of the American Revolution that are happening that are significant to people living in the Chicago area, but it doesn't really make an impact in the international negotiations that result in the border settlements.
Okay, and maybe we can just start wrapping up by looking at the effects of the American Revolution from the time of the Declaration of Independence to the official founding of Chicago in 1837. Yes. So do you just want to quickly talk
sure.
through that period?
So immediately in the wake of the revolution, as I say, these anti-British Indians they're really in charge, and Chicago Portage is definitely native ground. And this is the key transportation corridor in North America to link the Mississippi Valley with the Great Lakes. But the worm begins to turn in the 1790s, when it is the Americans now that are pushing further territorial claims westward. And this really becomes a problem in 1803 when Fort Dearborn, the United States government, establishes a military garrison at the Chicago Portage. This is the kind of intrusion that they had fought to keep the British from doing. Now the Americans have done that. And, of course, it's in these same years that Jean-Baptiste Pointe de Sable, who is recognized as the founder of Chicago, he is there throughout the 1790s as the principal trader for the mixed villages of Odawa and Potawatomi. He's there because he's married to a Potawatomi woman. He's got a French background. He's probably being supported and supplied through St. Louis. So all the things that they had thought were happening the way they wanted them to worked out until this garrison gets established in 1803. And then that becomes a cause belli for the native people, which they will eventually act on in 1812. When the War of 1812 breaks out, they attack Fort Dearborn and they destroy the garrison and burn the fort to once more ensure that it is simply native ground.
Right, and the burning of Fort Dearborn and the end of the War of 1812 leads, of course, then to a stronger response from the new U.S. government, yes?
Indeed. And the real transformation of that swampy portage into what's going to become a dynamic metropolis.
Great. What a fascinating story. And I'm certainly happy to know myself that, in fact, Chicago or Chicagoland did play an important role in the American Revolution and in the Declaration of Independence. Ted, I ask all of my guests just to end by reflecting on the Declaration of Independence for the 250-year anniversary. So you're a historian. As you look at the Declaration of Independence now, 250 years in the future, what do you think?
I think it's a humbling document for people if they reflect on the hypocrisies that are part of the Declaration and also the admirable aspirations of Enlightenment ideas that are in the document as well, ideas that we struggle with to this very day. If you look at the original draft of the document, where Thomas Jefferson talks about the institution of slavery, he puts in bold capital letters the word men when he refers to those people who were enslaved, in an implicit recognition of their humanity, as well as, of course, his own involvement in keeping such people as slaves. So,
and he also used the words merciless Indian savages, though, too.
He did.
Speaking of the contradictions.
Yeah, right. So it's a document that we struggle to live up to, I think. And because of that, it's always been, except perhaps in more recent weeks, it's always been, in that way, something that has made America a better country than it might otherwise have been.
Fine words to end. Professor Karamanski, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.